It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The idea of making a recipe that your ancestors might have made is very romantic, but if you've ever spent any time perusing old cookbooks or recipe cards, you know that you can get into trouble pretty fast. Thanks to two bloggers and scholars, some very old recipes are once again baking and bubbling in kitchens. Alyssa Connell is a PhD candidate in English at the University of Pennsylvania, and Marissa Nicosia is a visiting assistant professor of English at Scripps College in Claremont, California. Their blog is Cooking in the Archives. They're updating early modern recipes from 1600 to 1800 in a modern kitchen. Hello, ladies.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for being here today. And Marissa, I'll start with you. How did this get started?
You know, we were learning how to read 16th and 17th and 18th century handwriting when we were PhD students at the University of Pennsylvania. And there was this group called the Penn Paleography Collective, where a bunch of different scholars, librarians, graduate students would bring in materials for people to read, and we read some recipes occasionally, and Alyssa and I always wondered what these recipes would be like if we actually cooked them. And that was kind of the impetus for our project, was a curiosity to cook something after we'd been doing this training. And the Kislak Center for Special Collections, Rare Books, and Manuscripts at the University of Pennsylvania has a fantastic collection, and that's where we got our start.
The handwriting is a challenge in and of itself, but Alyssa, once you learn to read the handwriting, when you read these recipes, you have a lot more work to do, right?
Yes. And that's actually part of how we choose the recipes. We're striving for a good balance of things that might look familiar, like some of the cookies. Once we've gotten into them, one recipe actually turned out quite like modern snickerdoodles, or other recipes that seem somehow unfamiliar, like one for carrot pudding, which we wanted to cook just to find out what exactly carrot pudding would look like or taste like. So it's been a balancing act for ingredients that are accessible enough to us, or that can be sourced as substitutes for ingredients that we can't find.
Well, and I can imagine that there are probably a lot of familiar ingredients that are written about in a very unfamiliar way. Marissa, maybe you can give me an example of some of the things you've run into that took some decoding.
So one ingredient that is common throughout some of these savory recipes, drink recipes, and sweet recipes is verjuice. And this is a kind of spirit distilled from unripe grapes that apparently has a tartness like vinegar or sharp lemon. And some small producers in the U.S. and in Europe do make this. Alyssa and I haven't gotten our hands on any, though, because we can't seem to find it anywhere. So we've been substituting vinegar, mostly lemon, when recipes require verjuice, but that's been a kind of funny one. One thing that we've seen a lot of also is rose water, which is available widely in specialty grocery stores that people don't cook with so much these days, but it's absolutely all over these early modern recipes.
Are there ingredients that, like with this verjuice, how did you figure out what it was?
Well, first there was a transcription problem, because it wasn't spelled the way we spell it now. So we kept some of the spelling started with a W, W-E-R-J-U-S. We were trying to figure out what this word was. And through consulting the Oxford English Dictionary and a lot of Googling, we ended up figuring out that this was probably a word for verjuice. And then we went looking for it. Now, so that's a place where we're providing a lot of, using a lot of our tools for academic research to negotiate between these early texts and what a modern cook would actually want to do in the kitchen.
A lot of these recipes are also lacking measurements, Alyssa. I can imagine that is an incredible challenge.
Yes, it's been the measurements as well as things like cooking times, and this is where it's been particularly helpful to have some baking and cooking background just in our sort of extracurricular activities, that we are able to guesstimate in a lot of cases what temperature a moderately hot oven might in fact be, which is the kind of language you'll see in these recipes, or let your oven be pretty hot is another phrase we've seen quite frequently.
So how do you deal with the measurements, though? I mean, that seems to me like it would be even more difficult, and maybe that's just because I'm not a cook or a baker particularly, but you know, you can guess about oven temperature. You can leave it in longer. You can leave it in, you know, a shorter period of time. But how do you know how much to put in the recipe?
Well, I think one of the interesting things we're seeing is sort of a similarity maybe to modern cookbooks in that most of the more precise measurements are found in the baking recipes, where you would actually want that kind of precision about exactly how much flour, et cetera. And then it's in some of the savory recipes that we're seeing put in some time or some more vague amounts of ingredients, which might be more similar to how we cook now. You have a lot more leeway for experimentation with making a roast meat dish, perhaps, than with some sort of very particular cake.
Now, if I was baking a cake in the 17th century, for example, and I was using flour, I can imagine that the flour that I would be using would not be this fine, white, all-purpose flour that we can buy at the grocery store. So do you have to try to match what they would have been able to get at that time, Marissa?
We actually aren't really striving for full-on authenticity in our process. So we know that the flour would have been completely different. It would have been freshly milled. It would have been a lot like what some particularly trendy artisanal bakers are working with nowadays to make amazing things. So instead of testing like moisture and different things like that along the way as we go to see if we need to make small alterations because of the sourcing differences, but we're not trying to full-on recreate these things in the way that they would have been made in the 17th century.
Well, and there's a lot of fun on your blog, and it's very accessible and chatty, and clearly you guys are having a good time with this. But what is your goal in not just in decoding these recipes, but in preparing them?
I think really, I mean, to have the same kind of fun that we do approaching a lot of the cookbooks that we own that have been printed in this century is to find something new and think, oh, I wonder what that tastes like or what that's going to look like once I've made it. And that curiosity really sources a lot of this. So I think we will continue to cook and explore and look for things that spark that curiosity to find out what exactly this is or how it will turn out.
When you make a recipe, about how many times do you usually have to make it before you get what you think is the right mix?
Well, you know, because we're doing this blog at the intersection of kind of public history and food blogging, we're showing everyone our first try. So we're doing a detailed transcription. We're coming up with a modern ingredient list from our transcription and figuring out what we can actually get at the store and what we can't get and giving it a whirl. And that's what we're reporting on right now. So this does not yet have the kind of rigorous recipe testing you would see in a cookbook. It's a kind of a first sweep. And sometimes we've made mistakes and sometimes we've made happy mistakes.
So what was the first recipe? Did you guys make a first recipe together? Or, I mean, I know you're many miles apart right now, but Alyssa, did you start making these things together?
We did start making them together. And Marissa, do you remember the first recipe we made together?
We made the macaroni cheese.
Yes. 18th century macaroni and cheese with sherry in it that you bake in the oven with an egg. And it was such a wonderful, delicious success that we knew we were onto something from the start.
So is there a recipe that you've made that if you had made it first, maybe this would not have continued?
You know, we made a fish custard when we were actually made this one together when we were still cooking in the same place. And it's supposed to be a kind of almond milk custard with fresh fish roe in it. And this was a place where our misunderstanding about method and some issues sourcing ingredients turned out something that was one of the most disgusting things I've ever eaten in my entire life. But it was a worthwhile experiment to learn about some of the things that we'd done wrong. And I don't know if it would have tasted all that much better if we'd done it right. But
I was going to say, it just sounds like a pretty terrible idea.
Mixed blessing of the fish custard, I think it would have been a different, might have been a different project.
And why did you decide to make the fish custard?
You know, I saw it when I was scanning one of the manuscript recipes, and I thought that it sounded so outlandish And it also had this resonance with Matt Smith's Doctor Who character eating fish fingers and custard in an episode of the TV show Doctor Who, that I thought that was funny, and I thought readers might be interested in seeing, especially nerdy Doctor Who fan readers, might be interested in seeing what a 17th century fish custard was like.
So you mentioned the carrot pudding earlier. What did that turn out like?
It turned out wonderfully. It's actually a fairly even mixture of carrots and apples, so it has a sweetness to it, and then the spices are very similar to what you'd find in a pumpkin pie filling. So this is actually one that we've made a few times and adjusted things like the kinds of apples or the amount of heavy cream involved and come up with a couple of different variations on it, but I think we really enjoyed it, and so is everyone else that we foisted it on as guinea pig test tasters.
So when you make something like that, I mean, obviously it's something most of us have never had, but most of us are familiar with pumpkin pie. Is there something about the flavor that if I was just tasting it and I didn't know what it was, I would think, this is different than something I would normally eat?
I think for some of them, yes, especially with the rosewater, as Marissa mentioned. But what's been striking about some of these is that the flavors like cinnamon or the orange juice that's in the carrot pudding are actually quite familiar to us. So there's maybe not such a taste profile difference between a recipe from the 18th century and tastes that are still wonderful to us now.
What is your favorite recipe that you've made, Alyssa?
Still the mac and cheese. We're still okay. Striving to match that first one, and also some of the cookies that we've been making along the way.
What about you, Marissa?
We made these cookies called Jumbles that are just delicious.
What are they like?
They have caraway seeds in them, and they're somewhere between, they're kind of shortbread with caraway. I think they also had coriander seeds in them, Alyssa. They also had some of those. They just had this really wonderful fragrance, and they were wonderful with a cup of tea.
This is obviously a lot of fun for you, and it's a tremendous challenge. But why do you think it's important to not just to preserve these recipes, because obviously they're being housed in an archive, they're being preserved, but to interpret them and make them accessible?
One of the important ways about how they're being preserved is that they've been digitized and they're available online and they're open access. And so anyone really who's interested can go and look at them. And that's one of the things that we like so much about this project, is the idea that someone could actually be interested enough and use this as a kind of gateway to go in and flip digitally through some of these cookbooks that might not otherwise, you know, be read by more than a few people who happen to know that they were there. And I think beyond that, bridging, and this is the kind of romantic idea you brought up at first, bridging this gap between several centuries ago and our life now and what that looks like in the kitchen in terms of cooking, but also in terms of eating, has become important to both of us.
Marissa, when you're reading these recipes, do you think about the person who was writing them?
Oh, I definitely do. And there are marks in a lot of these books of those people. So sometimes there's X's next to the recipes, kind of maybe indicating that they'd been used. Sometimes there's the word probatum est, this Latin phrase that says, like, I have proved it, I have made it, and it works. So sometimes people left notes for themselves and for their the future generations of readers within their own families that they imagined using the book, and maybe even posterity. And there are sometimes names, and there are a lot of women's names in this archive. And I think that as a kind of feminist scholar, it's very important. This is partly a women's history project as well as a food history project.
Well, I can imagine that during the period of time that these recipes were written, mostly women were in the kitchens, but also this would have been outlet for women to be creative and to share their knowledge.
This is a very important kind of women's knowledge. And one thing that we haven't mentioned today, but is very clear when you look at the books themselves, is that they mix medicinal recipes along with culinary recipes in equal measure. So there'll be a cure for your salve to put on a wound next to a recipe for cookies. And this was a kind of the woman's kind of prerogative, was to control this kind of information that would deal with the body, both feeding it and healing it.
When I read these recipes, one of the things that I'm struck by is the amount of knowledge that whoever was reading and cooking these recipes at the time had to bring to the table. You guys are filling in a lot of those gaps of knowledge, but when I read these recipes, I don't even know where I would start.
It really impresses us as well to see what would have been a kind of base level of knowledge to approach a recipe and how much more accustomed we've been to having everything written out much more explicitly. And you can see the slight differences too in levels between similar recipes written out in different hands in different books might include slightly differing levels of specificity of instructions, which is striking to see as well.
Are you getting letters and comments from a lot of other people who are reading your blog and trying to make these recipes too?
We've been getting some wonderful letters and responses and comments on Twitter. People are sharing photos of our recipes when they've cooked them, which is awesome, and we're really excited to see that. People are telling us about the substitutions they've made. If they don't like orange blossom water or can't find it, they've sometimes used cinnamon or something instead, and it seems to work. And we're also getting some really great encouragement and support from other historical cooking blogs and endeavors, like the Historical Cooking Project out of Canada and the Recipes Hypotheses blog, which is a forum for a lot of scientific and recipe scholars to discuss manuscript recipe books.
And is there a next challenge that you guys are eyeing, Alyssa?
I think mostly we're looking forward to continuing cooking. I have a recipe on deck called Artificial Potatoes, which have no potatoes in them whatsoever. They seem to be fried cookie crumbs held together, so things like that keep us going, and then we're eager to see where the project takes us from there.
All right. Well, good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for being here today. I was talking with Alyssa Connell. She's a PhD candidate in English at the University of Pennsylvania, and Marissa Nicosia, who is a visiting assistant professor of English at Scripps College in Claremont, California. Their blog is Cooking in the Archives. They're updating early modern recipes from 1600 through 1800. You can also find them on Twitter at @rare_cooking. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.